From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Guerlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Manufactured goods, oil and gas, and the aerospace industry contribute to a robust trade partnership between Oklahoma and the United Kingdom.
I mean, the UK is already the fifth largest market for exports of goods and services from Oklahoma. And the value, actually, to your local economy of trade with the UK is getting on for $500 million.
I'll talk with British Consul General Karen Bell about trade, security, and Brexit. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss the outcome of last Sunday's independence vote in the Catalan region of Spain and this week's action by the Trump administration to expel several Cuban diplomats from the United States.
Last week, the United States decided to bring back all non-essentials. It's not looking like the relationship is doing all that well right now.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlot. Rebecca Cruz, last Friday, we talked about the coming referendum in Catalonia and the Catalan region of Spain. Of course, the vote was on Sunday. So let's just do a quick update because it was an interesting outcome. Of those that turned out to vote, overwhelmingly, 90% of them apparently voted for independence. Of those who turned out to vote, now less than half turned out to vote. So those that were motivated to come out and declare independence did. Those who are unsure about that stayed at home. And it is, and there is a lot of uncertainty. I mean, there were some clashes, of course, this week, protests, strikes. Spain obviously is not happy about this and is trying to squash it and has, you know, tried to prevent the referendum from happening to begin with. But there are a lot of questions about the practicalities of this, and of course the EU is kind of silent on it, not wanting to get into the middle of a separatist situation. So, Rebecca, give us the scoop about what we saw happen last Sunday and this week.
Well, as you said, about 42% came out to vote, which is still multiple millions of people. Some did stay home because they weren't sure, but there were also claims that the government had closed polling places and there were other ways of discouraging people from going in. So that certainly affected the turnout as well. This is going to be interesting. We're seeing back and forth between the king is getting involved here as well as the leader of the Catalan region. And this, of course, goes back centuries. Catalan has been its own region for quite some time. It faced some pretty harsh pushbacks during the Franco years. So during the dictatorship, the Catalan language was suppressed. People couldn't name their children what would be termed Catalan names. And so that was really a time when this region was really struggling and was being suppressed by the government. And so after Franco left in the 1970s, they again became part of a larger Spain, were given some autonomy. And this has really been really a situation for the last 6 or 7 years. And it happened to coincide with the economic crisis of 2008. So there was a legal ruling around that time that said that Catalan should have slightly less autonomy. And the courts came out in supporting that. And so we really start to see this pick up. And that's where this is coming from. But the practicalities here, we don't know what's going to happen. One of the biggest complaints of the Catalan people is that they are making a ton of money that's going to support the rest of Spain, particularly after the economic crisis. Think of Barcelona. It's a mega tourist hub. And so they're making a lot of money there. But what would really happen if they were to break? What would happen to the country? What would happen with EU membership? The EU has, as you said, stayed out, but they've also said that this is not an automatic. If Catalan becomes its own country, it will not automatically join the EU. So that is definitely an issue there. We will see what's going to happen. Just recently, a court came out and said that the Parliament of Catalan will not meet next week, as was planned. So we don't know if the Declaration of Independence is going to come in the next couple of days or not.
Well, Spain, of course, has the authority. The Spanish Prime Minister has the authority to dismiss all of the representatives and the parliament in Catalonia. Of course, that is, I think, something that would be particularly aggressive in this case. But this is, like you said, a longstanding thing, obviously distinct history, language, culture. But, you know, the political and economic nature of this is really in question. And not only the future of Spain, but the future of Spain and the European Union and Catalonia, perhaps. So,
and other regions that might be.
Well, exactly. I mean, Catalonia is not alone in this regard. So, again, why the EU perhaps is hesitant to get involved. Well, let's move to the Caribbean. Let's talk about Cuba. We have talked recently about Cuba a few times, actually, but one time in particular regarding American American diplomats in Cuba that were suffering some interesting symptoms: hearing loss, dizziness, headaches, balance issues, visual problems, problems seeing. There was some question about whether they weren't being targeted. There was some sort of acoustic attack, maybe a toxin. They're not sure. But some of the American diplomats had to come home because to be treated medically for this. In response this week to that, and I think perhaps an unwinding of this relationship as it had kind of been ramping up under the Obama administration, the United States, President Trump, expelled Cuban diplomats from the United States. So we are, again, in this very tense relationship. Cuba, of course, does not claim responsibility for any of this, doesn't know what's going on, but this is perhaps indicative of where we're headed with Cuba.
Yeah, absolutely. This relationship has deteriorated in the last 8 to 9 months. Last week, the United States decided to bring back all non-essentials. And so there are only 27 people at the embassy in Havana. And so that was the argument, the twofold, that, Cuba isn't doing enough to deal with this issue, and also that their diplomatic corps here should be about roughly the same size. So that's why those folks were expelled. But we will definitely keep watching this because there's a travel warning, as was mentioned, and we don't know where this is going, but it's not looking like the relationship is doing all that well right now.
All right. Well, Rebecca, thank you, as always, for being here this week.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at Worldviews KGOU and I'm at Suzette Gorlat. Next, I'll talk with British Consul General Karen Bell about the UK's trade relations with Oklahoma and how Britain will navigate Brexit. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Karen Bell serves as the Consul General for the United Kingdom and is based in Houston. She works to enhance trade relationships between the UK and Oklahoma, Texas, and three other states. Bell's role also involves promoting science and technology partnerships. I spoke with Karen Bell in the KGOU studios. Karen Bell, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, Suzette, thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited to be here.
It's great to have you here. And so I want to start with the work that you're doing as the Consul General of the United Kingdom, stationed in Houston. Some of the things you're focused on are enhancing trade and investment and promoting science and innovation and that sort of thing. So can you maybe start there and tell us a little bit about the work that you're actually doing and how you're connecting to Oklahoma?
Well, thank you. Yes, you're right. I mean, I cover a five-state area, and Oklahoma is very always very near the top of my list. This is, I think, my fourth visit since I took up my role in Houston 2 years ago, and trade and investment is a very important part of my sort of suite of responsibilities. I mean, I had a really good conversation with the Lieutenant Governor, and we were talking about the opportunities to further develop our trade and investment relationship. It's already in great shape. I mean, the UK is already the fifth largest market for exports of goods and services from Oklahoma. And the value actually to your local economy of trade with the UK is getting on for $500 million, covering a whole range of sectors. So it's a really good news story. But there's always scope for us to do more. So one of the reasons that I'm here is just to kind of scope out some of those opportunities.
So what are the commodities that we are engaging in this trade on? What are we sending to the UK?
It's a good cross-section of stuff. The aerospace industry is an important part of it. Manufactured goods, you'd expect that in a state like Oklahoma that oil and gas would be a part of the story, and it is. But also it's increasingly about services. So, you know, it's about transportation services, tourism, logistics, which is, you know, obviously of growing importance here.
the UK is one of the top destinations for Americans. But as of late, there's been, you know, some negative news as well. So how is the UK managing that sort of thing in terms of tourism and attracting people to the UK?
Well, you're right. I mean, the US is a massively important market for us, and we so welcome all of our visitors from the US. And certainly, while I don't have the detailed numbers for Oklahoma, I can say that on all of my visits here, it's hard to find somebody who hasn't sort of spent some time in the UK, and we really appreciate that and want to see that part side of our relationship grow. Something I would say is that over the last year, the exchange rate's been fantastically in the favour of anybody spending dollars. We've been running a bit of a fire sale, so that's one more great reason to come and see us. I think what you're alluding to in terms of some of the challenges has been some of the, you know, the awful security incidents that we've had to deal with. Of course, the UK has not been alone in that, and it's another very important dimension of our relationship with the US that we stand shoulder to shoulder on all of these issues. And I think there's no closer relationship than the one that you would see between our military and also our security and intelligence services. What I would say for anybody thinking about a trip to the UK, quite aside from the quality of our offer. I mean, Americans understand like nobody else, you know, the wonderful sort of heritage, the cultural offer. Increasingly, it's about our sort of countryside and those second city trips, which so many American tourists are now able to make. What I would say is that I have been back to the UK, I think I was there the week after the Westminster attack, and life goes on as normal. You know, we're an incredibly resilient country. There's a real sort of, we didn't coin the phrase keep calm and carry on for no reason. But what people will see is that we are taking seriously the policing of our major cities. So, for example, last week there was a more visible police presence in response to the last incident we had. And that's just part of an effective policing response.
Let's return to trade and economics for a minute, because obviously, to me, the biggest issue on the table must be for you too, is the impending exit of the UK from the European Union, what we know as Brexit. There obviously have been a lot of political ramifications, how it's affecting some of your domestic politics in the UK. So what are we to think now about where this is headed and what the implications are going to be for the UK longer term on the trade and economic side?
Well, thank you. You're right. I mean, it is the number one political issue of the day in the UK at the moment. And I think one of the things we've seen over the last year is, party politics aside, there is a strong sense of agreement that we are definitely on a one-way journey, which will take us out of the European Union at the end of March in 2019. And so we're now engaged in a detailed process of preparing for what our relationship with Europe will look like after we leave the EU, but also thinking about the real opportunities that our departure from the EU means for relationships with other partners, none more important to us, of course, than the United States. The Prime Minister gave a very wide-ranging speech in Florence, and that really, I think, set out some very important key principles for the kind of relationship that we want to have and the constructive way in which we want to be engaging with our European partners as we really get into the nuts and the bolts of our negotiation. I mean, some of the things that we've made very clear from the start, but are sort of intensifying our efforts around us, making clear that although we're leaving the European Union, we're not leaving Europe. It's going to continue to be a massively important partner for us on everything that matters to people. So, for example, at the moment, it is our largest export market, and it really matters to us that we have the most frictionless trading relationship with Europe in a post-Brexit world. And what we want to see is a bespoke framework for the UK and the EU. You know, we are such a large economy in the continent. It makes sense, it seems to us, on both sides, that we don't do anything to impede the contribution that two-way trade makes to jobs and growth in the UK and in the EU. We've published a position paper last month which talks about what a future customs arrangement might look like and put forward a couple of quite substantive ideas for consideration by the negotiating teams on both sides. And for us, a really important part of that, of course, is ensuring that what we don't end up with is a return to a hard border between the UK and the Republic of Ireland. That's our only land border with the rest of the European Union. And I think both sides are absolutely clear that we can have no return to that. So there needs to be a kind of a creative solution found, and a number of ideas have been put forth on that. The other thing that we've been very clear about is that we really want to look after those EU citizens who have made their home in the UK in the period that we've been in the European Union. We hugely value the contribution that they have made to our national life, to our economy, and we want to make sure that they feel safe and secure and that they and their families have certainty about what their future looks like in a post-Brexit world. And so, again, one of the things that the Prime Minister talked about was guaranteeing the rights of EU citizens who live in the UK. There will be no change to the way in which their life feels. They will have the same, they'll enjoy the same rights as they have done sort of up to 2019. There will be a conversation to be had about what our immigration arrangements look like with citizens of other European countries after 2019. But again, I think it's part and parcel of us wanting to continue that sort of closeness, that friendship, and not making life more difficult.
Could we talk for just a second about the domestic political ramifications of this? There was not an even vote on whether to remain or to exit, for example. And so what do you foresee happening maybe with Scotland or other parts of the UK that have interests in maintaining that relationship and would have preferred to remain? And so the political parties that are now kind of mm-hmm. lining up in different directions. And so some of the real concerns, I think, for everyone in the UK and elsewhere that are interested in this part of the world, kind of what's going to happen inside the country beyond the issue of immigration.
Yeah, no, Susan, I think you raise a really excellent point. And I think one of the things that's been absolutely essential to sort of deciding what our negotiating position is going to be is bringing in the views from all parts of the United Kingdom. So, the devolved administrations in Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland are absolutely sort of essential contributors to forming our positions. In the same way that we want to talk to on economic issues, we need to understand what different industry groups are saying too. Because if we come out with a deal which doesn't respond to the broad range of interests, then as government we won't have done our job. But I'm not going to pretend it's straightforward. There is a lot to be hashed out. But I think we've been clear from day one that Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, the cities too, which are of course increasingly important in terms of having a particular set of interests, that those concerns are sort of reflected in the things that we are asking for as we go into the negotiations.
Immigration clearly seems to be one of the maybe top issues beyond economy, jobs, but it's also related to that too. It also seems to be related to perhaps some security issues that you've been facing. So is this kind of a driving issue for a lot of this Brexit movement? Is it kind of at the top of the list of how do we deal with the immigration issue? And maybe that will help us solve some of the other political, economic and social issues that are on the forefront.
So immigration was obviously one of a number of factors, as far as we can tell from the sort of the post-referendum sort of an analysis that's been done. I don't know whether it was the only one. I mean, I think we've always had a slightly sort of difficult relationship with Europe. I don't think philosophically Brits have ever really felt quite as European as, our French and German counterparts. And that's partly because we're an island nation, and it's just, it hasn't been the way that our kind of culture has evolved. But, getting back control of immigration alongside a sense that I think people wanted to bring decision making back to Westminster, that there was, a concern that Brussels was increasingly sort of involved in parts of public life where people felt that those decisions might have been better taken closer to home. So I think there are a number of factors at play there. In terms of what our future relationship looks like, I say a number of these things are going to need to be worked out. And so I haven't got a crystal ball that says what our migration relationship will look like. But I think we have been very clear that one of the reasons we will be leaving the single market is because we understand that for our European partners, that the four freedoms are absolutely inextricably interwoven, and you can't pick and choose. And we understand and we respect that. But I definitely don't think you're going to see is some kind of pulling up of drawbridges. That's actually the complete reverse of the Britain that we want to be post Brexit. We've always been an economy that's absolutely founded on free trade. Our universities, we're sitting here in a wonderful university. Our universities have been centres of learning, which have been open to ideas. We actually want to be even more effective global players and global citizens as we look towards our future post Brexit. And so, for example, I mean, to sort of extend the sort of the university side of the story, we were very clear at a very early stage that we wanted to preserve funding arrangements for European programmes. So I think as far back as August last year, we'd already got an announcement from our Treasury Department that there would be guarantees of sustained funding to ensure we could continue to have those research collaborations. But here in the US, I mean, we just signed a really important bilateral US-UK agreement on science and technology cooperation. And that's part of what we would see as a suite of new opportunities for us to broaden our engagement with other partners, including, as I say, here in the US. And free trade is something which we can't talk about yet because we like to play by the rules, you know, we didn't invent cricket for nothing. We can't start negotiating a free trade agreement until such time as we have left the EU. We can and we are already doing some pretty intensive preparatory work to ensure that as soon as we are legally able to, we can make progress and hopefully get signed a free trade agreement with the US.
Thank you so much, Consul General Karen Bell, for being here today to talk about this because we're all watching with great interest. So thank you so much.
Well, it's been a huge pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Karen Bell. She's the Consul General for the United Kingdom in Houston. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced this show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlatte.